everyone. Welcome to Peer to Peer Real Estate Show. I'm your host, Willie Morales. And on today's show, I got Andrew Lanoy. Did I get your last name right?
You got it. You nailed it.
Oh, great. Andrew is a founder, investor, speaker, author, and co-founder and managing partner of Four Peaks Capital Partners. And he's the host of the Impatient Investor Podcast. Andrew, thank you so much for being on Peer to Peer Real Estate. How are you?
Hey, thanks. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I was really excited to this, looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, no, definitely me too. So Andrew, jumping right in, were you always entrepreneurial? Was this something that you grew up with, get into real estate? Is it something that you fell into? I'm always fascinated by, you know, people like yourselves that have that entrepreneurial spirit at such a young age.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm in Phoenix now. I've been here for about 3 years, but I was in Los Angeles for about 20 years. And if you've seen the show Entourage on HBO, I actually worked for that company, the William Morris Agency, for about 16 years. I was in entertainment for the better part of 20 years. And what happened was the subprime crash happened, and I'm a pretty high income W-2 earner in a pretty big, you know, big industry, big talent agency. And subprime crash happened, and my parents got hit pretty hard. They were retired. They did what their financial advisor told them to do, which was put the money in the market, save, not really invest in assets or passive income. And they got hit really hard. And so that was kind of my eye opening. Well, how the heck does this happen to, you know, lower middle class? Dad's a plumber, mom's a nurse, and they worked really hard with the, you know, put three kids through school and everything.
Right.
And so that was during the subprime crash, and read a million books, and it really just all led me to real estate investing, and started to buy single family houses in Dallas, Texas back in 2009, which, you know, hindsight's always 2020, but was a great time to get into the market, and was pretty aggressive from about 2009 to 2013, buying single families, and it ended up being in Dallas, Memphis, and Atlanta, which were all pretty solid markets for single family. And that's how I kind of got into real estate. I accidentally timed the market.
No, I mean, that's amazing. And let's talk about a little bit about working at the William Morris Agency. When the crash happened, and even before that, did you see any indication of a real estate bubble, or just in general, a market crash? Was any type of, you know, indication for you, like, hey, you know what, I better start maybe putting a little bit more money away, or maybe telling your parents to put a little bit more money away? How was that for you at that time? You know, obviously it's in hindsight, but when you look back at it.
Yeah, I think that we were pretty insulated in that industry. We weren't really, I mean, one of the big indicators is always what the housing prices, right? And so we were prior leading up to that, housing was, I mean, the subprime was really a real estate crash, a real estate crisis. So other than knowing that prices were really high, I honestly just wasn't paying attention, along with most other people. I was, you know, had a pretty good job, a really great career, made a lot of money. So we weren't really looking at stuff like that. And that was when the market crashed, and it was like, well, how does mom and dad lose that big of a percentage in their portfolio?
Right.
And then you really start to dig in what happened during the subprime. And it really boils down to, you know, I tell this story all the time. It's like my dad's father grew up, got married, raised three kids, one salary, lower middle class, put them all through school, owned a home, owned a car. That's gone, right? Like, that was the American dream, is you could do it on one salary back in that generation.
Yeah.
And that's gone now, right? And so now it's not uncommon for mom and dad, if they happen to still be together, to be working four jobs between both of them, and they're barely making ends meet. You know, the numbers are pretty staggering. It's 50% of wage earners in the country that are making typically $31,000 or less a year. And you figure out, well, what does that get you for a housing allowance? And it's not very much. It's certainly, I think the median mortgage, the last I saw, was maybe about $1,200 a month. Like, you're taking home $23,000 a year. You can't afford that. You know, you can't afford that kind of a mortgage. And generally you're renting for the most part.
Yeah, and that's eating up. I mean, like you said, you have a mortgage of $1,200. You're making, you know, just a $31,000 a year less taxes and yep. medical expenses. My God, and you hit it on the head though. What our parents and our grandparents grew up in definitely doesn't work anymore. Now it all, like you said, it adds up to having a couple of jobs, or like now the new term side hustle. And I don't think a lot of people still see that though, Andrew. I still think a lot of people relying on just a two income family, but I think in this generation moving forward, as we progress in 2021, 22, 23, we got to have multiple streams of income.
Right. Right. And that's it. And that doesn't necessarily mean that's multiple W-2 jobs, right?
Right.
But it's really building up that passive income. I think this whole, the whole COVID and coronavirus has really shined a light. I don't know the last numbers that are out there as far as jobless claims, but I think we're pretty close to 50 million last I saw. I mean, that's a staggering number, 50 million yeah. jobless claims. And obviously that's not, you know, there's a correlation to the unemployment rate, but you know, let's say it's 6 months from now and half those folks are back to work. I'm just pulling a number out. So does that mean that we're at 25 or 30% unemployment, which that's a staggering number too. And we don't really know how that's going to affect the economy overall, but we certainly see all of these businesses that are filing for bankruptcy and going yeah. out. And, you know, imagine being an office space owner during this time. Imagine being a retail owner. Imagine working in the entertainment business or concerts or sports. Or, I mean, it's been devastating to really see what happens, especially these industries that were really felt bulletproof for all of these years. So mm-hmm. I think it's going to be months and months and months and months before we really know how much damage has happened to the economy. And of course, never mind printing trillions of dollars that go back into, you know, the economy to help kind of prop it up. I mean, I think it was like almost a third of the, you know, of the total debt that got pumped back in. I mean, that's staggering, right? And then of course, I mean, we talked about this for a second before the podcast, but there's just so much misinformation out there. So it's hard to really filter through that and know. But if you think about how many the percentage of small businesses that are out of business or going to be out of business, and the amount of mortgages that are expected to fail, and the courts being backed up for all this time, it can't not be a huge number. So you know, unfortunately, we're all just kind of sitting back trying to see how this is going to shake out and get back to business. But I'm glad I'm not an office space owner during all this time, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I remember I was looking at CNBC maybe 3 or 4 months ago, and they had one of the guys from the Shark Tank on, Kevin O'Leary, and sure. he was yeah. saying that he thinks, and for his business, he thinks that maybe 20% of his workforce, if I might be paraphrasing, are going to be working from home now. Because he says right. that he sees more and more production, because someone might have a loved one there to take care of, or maybe a newborn baby or something. But I mean, that's going to damage the office space, because like you just said, what's going to happen now? You know, if you're going to have, you know, a 20% vacancy rate now for offices around the, let's say, not only New York, but around the country.
Yeah. And even I would even say, I mean, imagine the first 30 days when this started. And let's say you had a portfolio of office buildings and you were at 82% occupied, you know, within 30 days, you're probably at 5% or zero. I don't know anyone who continued to work in an office during this. And certainly if you're in a hospital or you're an essential worker in a grocery yeah. store or a Target, of course, right? Those businesses were actually thriving during a lot of this. But, you know, we sent our team home 4 months ago and we still haven't fully been back into the office. And you know, here in Arizona, we started to reclose everything down again. So
right.
Just unbelievable, just devastating.
No, it is. And I like I said, you're in Arizona, I'm in New York, and I just saw what happened to a lot of these mom and pop stores. And I want to backtrack a little bit about your investing career. When you bought your first property, you said it was a single family. The key question, I'm pretty sure you always get this too, Andrew, is how do you fund it? How did you fund your first deal? Because that's always questions that I get from people is, oh, I don't have the money to get into real estate. I don't know what to do. Maybe wholesaling, partnering up. How did that, how did you go through that?
Yeah, it was actually pretty simple because, you know, at the time I was making a really good, pretty strong salary at the agency. I had good savings. I had great credit. And I going back to what I had mentioned earlier, was just accidentally timed that market in 2009, right. Buying homes in Dallas, Texas. You know, if I bought something at $125,000 with 5 to 20% down, depending on the product, that home was renting for $1,500 or $1,600. I mean, it was a no-brainer. And even though, you know, it depends on your property taxes and your insurance and a number of other things, those assets were cash flowing. I mean, that was the whole thing, was I wanted a cash flow model, an income model, which is why I lived in California for 20 years and never owned real estate there other than a primary residence.
Right.
So I think if I had gotten into the market 10 years after, it would not have been able to pencil out. Like, buying single families now is really, really difficult. We're probably at the top of the market right now for a lot of places. I know here in Arizona, if you've got a home that's $300,000 or $350,000, I don't know the median price here, but you know, you've got 20 offers on that home. And same thing around different parts of the country when I talk to folks. So I think there's a lot of ways, kind of back to your question, there's a lot of ways to get into real estate. Maybe someone has really great credit, but they don't have the down payment. And so maybe you work out a partnership with someone.
Right.
I did a lot of friends and family deals once I started to get going and realized, hey, I could buy a house for $100,000 and it's going to cash flow and it's in a good, stable, strong market. Dallas ended up being a great market, but that was really job driven, right? And companies out of California were moving there and expansion. But I think there's a lot of creative ways to do it. Just figure out what your strengths are, and maybe you have terrible credit, but you have good, you have some cash that you could put into something, or maybe it's the opposite.
Right. No, that's a good advice. So for you, Andrew, once you did the single family properties, how did you graduate into multifamily? What made you get into that space quickly?
Yeah, so I think probably around 2013, properties were not really penciling out anymore as far as an income model. So it really jumped from that, you know, 2009 to 2013. I looked at a bunch of other asset classes. I looked at commercial. I looked at multifamily. And really, I think what I found that was the most compelling was the supply and demand for affordable housing in the United States. And it goes back to 50% of wage earners are making less than $31,000 a year, and what can they afford to pay on a monthly basis for a housing allowance? And so there was this huge demand for affordable housing, and that's really the direction that I decided to go, and that's kind of how we built the companies around, was based on affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And you know, thankfully, knock on wood, our collections have been okay through all of this. A little bit down, but certainly not like retail or not like office space.
Right. So let's talk more about affordable housing, because here in New York City, when a developer has a plan, 20% of the units have to be low income. Now it depends. It could be under 30,000, a family of two or three, you know, there's all types of criteria. How do you set up your criteria for affordable housing?
Yeah, in general, I mean, we're not in big MSAs because it just doesn't really pencil out as far as an income model. I mean, it goes back to California. If you went and you bought an asset in California and you held it for 20 years, you're probably going to double the value of that, maybe even triple that during that time, and even through a crash, but it may barely cash flow. I mean, obviously, if you buy something in cash, it's going to cash flow to some degree, but we focused on secondary markets because that's where we found all of the deals. And as long as they, what we affectionately call one horse towns, as long as they're not one horse towns and it's not a meat packing plant 20 miles away that's the main job driver, as long as it's what's ended up being all the essential workers, the Amazon fulfillments, the Targets, Costco's, gas stations, grocery stores, et cetera. As long as there's an infrastructure there, that's the areas that we look in. And most of them happen to be in the Midwest, where in general land is fairly inexpensive. So that's been our model, and it's worked really well so far.
And how long have you been in these markets now? For the last, what, 4 or 5 years or longer?
About 6 years.
Did you find any, comparing Arizona to, let's say, Memphis or Dallas, were there any difference in terms of, I mean, obviously the pricing, but in terms of trying to get, money down, or did you go to private lenders? How did you build up that portfolio?
Yeah, I think the lending across the board, we're usually working with national lenders or brokers, and they can really go anywhere. So we don't own much real estate here in Arizona. It's actually very expensive, but it's been a great place to have the headquarters here, a great market to hire from as far as the labor and the job pool and everything. Not too much of a difference state by state as far as lending. I mean, we've done CMBS loans, we've done hard money loans, we've done everything in between, seller financed, bought things in cash. So it's kind of been across the board, and haven't run into too many hurdles or issues with state by state lending restrictions or anything like that.
Is there criteria when you have these units, let's say if you have 100 units, is there a percentage, or is the whole 100 unit affordable housing? Like I said, here in New York, you got to have at least 20%. How is in those markets, are there those type of numbers? How does those numbers work? Like,
yeah, there's no restrictions like that at all. And I think that's probably, obviously there's some layers there when you're buying something in New York City versus Missouri, right?
Right.
So we don't really have any of those restrictions. We're also, we chose to be in very landlord friendly states in general. Another reason we're not in California. Oregon had passed a rent control law pretty recently too. So, imagine owning real estate in Oregon, and you had bought some value add stuff where you depended on raising the rents a certain amount over 5 years or something like that. And now you're restricted to. So that's been pretty interesting. But generally, we're in very landlord friendly states. So if a resident has a problem, we can't work out a deal with them. And obviously putting all the COVID things aside, we can generally evict that person fairly quickly depending on the state. And just to be clear, just during all this time, I mean, I don't know if we evicted anyone. I think, the whole goal is really to make something work and keep as many residents in place as possible, which, our collections have actually been okay through all this so far.
In the markets that you're in, has the job market suffered anything? I mean, with the pandemic, like here, like I was telling, we talked earlier in New York City. I mean, we saw just tons and tons of mom and pop stores close. Some of them reopened, but what I've seen, most haven't. Any type of deals like that happen in the markets that you're in that you might have noticed?
Well, we've had a very low percentage of our residents that have lost their jobs through this. But if we're at 50 million jobless claims, like that's the big wild card right now for residential real estate, is what happens in 6 months. I don't know where we are with unemployment. I think we're past 20%. Does that get to, of those 50 million jobless claims, do half those folks get back to work in 6 months? Does unemployment go to 30%? I mean, all those things, it's so hard to, there's such staggering numbers, and it's so hard to predict how that's going to impact residential real estate across the board. Another thing that's pretty interesting, Chase might've been about 2 months ago announced that they were restricting their single family loans to, you now needed a minimum of a 700 FICO. Oh, yeah. And I think 20% down. I don't know if the other banks, the big banks, followed suit or not, but that affects residential real estate, right? That's going to push people. I mean, we hear America's turned into a renter nation. I mean, that's case in point right there. I mean, imagine if you had a 680 FICO and you were putting 10% down, you're in the middle of a loan, and Chase chains their loan parameters. Well, guess what? You're renting, right? Unless you can find another bank that's going to loan to you. So it's just been interesting. There's so many layers. It's very, very, very complex.
No, and I and it's funny. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think once I heard that too, when Chase raised their minimum to 700, how long before other banks do the same thing? Now, and like you said, are we, in your opinion, obviously, you know, what's happening, it's hard to say, but are we going to see more rent-to-own properties in the future? I mean, are we going to see more on the creative side where an owner and a future tenant buyer might work more together instead of relying on that conventional side of the business?
Yeah, I would think so. And usually what happens in a correction, and you know, we may not even technically be in a pandemic, we're certainly not in a real estate correction right now, or
right,
even technically a recession, but you know, in these events that are so massive, and obviously this is global, you know, one of the first things that happen is lending kind of freezes, or you know, CMBS stopped for a bit. People are still buying houses and moving, so that wasn't affected. Although, like a Chase, for example, with their rates, you know, their parameters changed. But I would, to answer your question, I would guess that that does bring some opportunities for folks that want to buy if the lending still stays pretty restricted. We're 4 months into this now. We're July 2020, so we're seeing more lenders that are now stepping up, but. 2 weeks ago, our state started closing down again, and so did, you know, Texas and Florida, and we talked about that earlier. So,
right,
who knows? I mean, a lot of this is on a, I feel like it's on a day-to-day or a week-by-week basis. You wake up and there's something that's changed. I mean, we don't even, you know, they're talking about 40 or 50% of commercial mortgages going under through all of this, which, you know, the courts are so backed up, we're not going to really see some of that for 6, 12, 18 months. So,
right.
But what's interesting is a lot of big companies were formed through the subprime crash. I think it was Airbnb and Uber and a handful, yeah, of other billion-dollar companies. So there's folks definitely working on things right now, because there's all of a sudden problems that didn't exist 5 months ago. So I'm sure in some short period of time, we'll start to see, you know, different companies or people solving, you know, it's entrepreneurs, right? They're solving problems.
There's always a, yeah.
Yeah.
No, exactly.
So it'll be interesting.
No, it should be, especially the rest of the year and early next year. So Andrew, talk more about your company, the Four Peaks Capital Partners. How did you form that? Was there a necessary need to form that? What made you come up with the idea, you and any of your partners?
Yeah. So it's myself and my partner, Mike Ayala. And it kind of goes back to when we were looking at what the next asset class was. Single family was really hard to make the numbers work as far as cash flow goes. And so it was going back and really looking at affordable housing, and it's kind of real estate investing 101. It's supply and demand, right?
Yeah.
So you've got 50% of the wage earners out there making less than $30,000 a year. They need safe, affordable housing. So that was really the mindset going into this, is we want to provide safe, clean, affordable housing for Americans. And until there's not a need for affordable housing anymore, we've got a good, solid business in place. You know, we hear about the middle class getting smaller, right? The middle class shrinking. And it's not because most of them are becoming millionaires are becoming more well off. It's usually quite the opposite. So I think we have a very underserved market in affordable housing here in the United States.
No, I definitely agree. I think that niche that you're trying to get into is definitely needed. So for you, with what's happening in the pandemic, what do you see Four Peaks doing in the future? Like, what are your goals for the company in the next 3 to 6 months? Obviously, it's hard to say because of what's happening in the world, but, well, at least here in the United States. But if you could look into a crystal ball, what does Andrew want to do with the company?
Yeah, I think it's just getting back to all facets of the company, getting back to work. We sent everyone home in the office 4 months ago, along with most other companies. We had a construction company with guys that would travel. We sent all of them home. Part of it was because in case there were travel bans and people getting stuck, you know, in these markets, not around their family during all this. So you know, it's like every day you're waking up and you're dealing with some new problem that didn't exist the week before. And I think it just as the next 3 to 6 months, it's really getting back to work. Right. It's continuing to buy property. It's continuing to fix up the properties that we own. And it feels like the lending is starting to loosen back up a little bit, but you know, again, it's almost like with everything starting to shut back down again, I don't know how that's going to impact it, but I don't think most real estate is really on sale right now, especially, you know, multifamily is a good example. I mean, if you're an apartment building owner, really hard to find good deals, really hard to find yield. A lot of the bigger operators are holding, or maybe they're selling. So I think for us, it's just getting back to business and getting the team back out and getting back to work.
No, I listen, I'm hoping that this, you know, it's so frustrating just being out there. And, you know, Andrew, you're out there, you're, whether you shopping or a business, it's just, people just getting sick, and we just gotta, you know, I don't want to get political or anything, but we just gotta take care of ourselves and just protect ourselves and protect our loved ones. For you, Andrew, I want to talk more about your podcast. I love the name of it, The Impatient Investor Podcast. I could definitely relate to that title. I did a show about a week ago that I was all over the place for my first 8-9 years of real estate. It took me till the end of 2016, early 2017 to finally pick my niche. So what is your podcast about?
Yeah, some of it is what we started to talk about today. And it's, you know, our whole platform is the American dream is dead, and what worked for your parents or your grandparents doesn't work anymore. So we teach people to create multiple streams of income. We're not big fans of the stock market in general. So it's alternative investing. And it's really creating your own economy. That's really kind of the main goal and mission, is to teach investors that there are ways, you know, outside of just their W-2 income, create multiple streams of income. We put a report together that's newstreamsofincome.com that we talk about this a little bit. And so that's a free report that we put together for anyone interested in learning a little bit more.
Yeah, I'll put that in the show notes. Listen, Andrew, I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to me and my audience. If somebody wants to get in contact with you, what's the best way?
The best way, so it's fourpeakspartners.com is our site. The Impatient Investor is the podcast. Those are probably the two best ways. We're on all the different social channels too.
All right. Sounds good. Well, again, Andrew, I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. Thank you so much.
Thanks, William. Great to talk with you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, everyone, that was Andrew Lanoy. You can find Andrew at investors@fourpeakscapitalpartners.com. That's investors@fourpeakscapitalpartners.com. Andrew, thank you so much for being on today's Peer-to-Peer Real Estate Show. Really, really appreciate it. You can find me at peer2peerrealestate.com. That's peer2peerrealestate.com. Check out our past shows, our blog, and our resource page. Also, if you guys go to Apple Podcasts, please look for us on Peer-to-Peer Real Estate. Please subscribe, leave a review, tell us how we can make this show better. And before I go, guys, there's a couple more things. Do not give up on your dreams. Fight for it. Protect it. Don't let anyone talk you out of it. And I really believe, keep the momentum going, good things will happen. Anyway, on behalf of Peer-to-Peer Real Estate, my name is Willie Morales. Until next time, thanks, everybody, and please stay safe. Bye.